You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So the Hebrews have gotten out of Egypt. They're rumbling down the coast. They eventually make it to this mount called Mount Sinai. That's where we ended last week. God comes down and says, are you guys going to follow this covenant or not? And they're all like, yeah, we've got this. And so God begins to reveal the Decalogue. Dec, like a decade, 10. Log, like logos, like words. It means 10 words. That's the correct name for this, not the 10 commandments. Then God gave the people all these words. Yeah. Dabal, translated to speak 840 times, to say 118. Obviously, that's what it means. And to pronounce, to commune, first definition, here's command. So it could mean command, but very rarely, and almost all of the times that is translated command is in connection with the 10 words. And translators prefer the 10 commandments. I don't like it. It's a traditional translation based on King James is where it got started. The 10 sayings would be another way to understand it. I am Yahweh, your God, who rescued you out of the land of Egypt, the place of your slavery. And so he begins his thinking in this whole area, I am Yahweh. Why start there? What's the point? The point is that without God, there can be no objective morality, okay? It's absolutely necessary that a God exists. Otherwise, we live in what we could call the no-God world. What's a new no-God world like? For one thing, it's material world. It's matter. It's energy. It's physics, natural law. And the problem is that matter is not moral. Ludwig Wittgenstein is considered one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. Some people think he's the greatest philosopher we had. Very sharp. He says, if we describe a murder with all of its details, a detailed physical and psychological, the mere description of these facts will contain nothing that we could call an ethical proposition. The murder will be on exactly the same level as any other event. For instance, the falling of a stone. A stone rolls down a hill. Is that morally good? Is that morally evil? It can't be moral at all. It's matter. Morality comes out of something higher than matter. Spiritual, real personhood. Morality is personal. He goes on and says, our words, used as we use them in science, are vessels capable only of containing and conveying meaning and sense, natural meaning, that is, natural meaning and sense. Ethics, if it's anything, is supernatural. And our words will only fit the facts. Just like a teacup cup will only hold a teacup full of water, even if you pour a gallon over it. The prison house of language. Wittgenstein is the father of linguistic analysis. He says, no state of affairs has in itself what I would like to call the coercive power of an absolute judge. And so there can be no ethics. To write or talk ethics or religion is to run against the boundaries of language. This running against the walls of our cage is perfectly, absolutely hopeless. So Wittgenstein, who's smarter than a lot of atheists, realized the connection between the existence of a personal God and the ability to conceive of, have moral thinking, to be able to think that anything is morally wrong. A lot of atheists today aren't that smart. Yeah, matter isn't moral. And also, under the no-God world, humans are just another species. They're just like other species. To think that humans are exceptional, to think that humans are something different, that's speciesism. Similar to racism, except now we're species. We're championing our species over the other species. Animal rights argues that the animal rights movement, and you can see exactly where they're coming from, how they get their point. I have to agree. In a no-God world. On the other hand, they try to construct a morality out of that, therefore we should be moral toward the animals, which doesn't follow. In fact, natural processes in nature are not moral. This thinker says it would be impossible to find a fox with a kindly protective disposition toward geese, just as no cat exists which has a friendly disposition toward mice. That's why the struggle between the various species does not arise from a feeling of mutual hate, but rather from hunger and really love. The baby kittens at home need to be fed. In both cases, nature looks on calmly and is even pleased with what happens. It's nature. There cannot be a separate law for mankind in a world in which planets and suns follow their orbits, where moons and planets trace their destined paths. Yeah, what causes a planet to follow its orbit? Physics, momentum, mass, speed. The planet doesn't say, well, I think I'll take another spin around. There's no decision being made. It's just matter and energy. And so we're going to say that we're something other than that. Here, your author, Adolf Hitler, in Mein Kampf. Yeah. He believed that. He believed in the struggle of the species, the struggle of the races, too. Why not? Hitler had a system of morality, and he held strictly to it, held others to it as well. To him, destroying the Jew was eliminating vermin. And so we can shudder at that all we want. But not only did he believe it, but large swathes of Europe believed the same thing. He was not the originator of it. He was not alone in it. But yeah, once we remove the presence of the spiritual, Wittgenstein admitted that the morality, if it exists, is supernatural, correct. The idea of objective morality, the whole concept of moral right and wrong, has no base, has nothing to rest on in the no-God world. Here's Sam Harris, one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse atheist, the four atheists, called the new atheists. He says we can be good without God. He said, we don't need God or a Bible to tell us what's right and what's wrong. We can know objective moral truths without the existence of a law-giving God, and we can judge Hitler to be morally reprehensible without reference to Scripture. Okay, yeah, you can do that. Has no basis. You could just as easily, you say Hitler was wrong, Hitler says, I was in the right. Which one of you, you know, is in the right? There's no way to know. There's no basis. There has to be a basis. It has to rest on something. Any moral tradition would have equal validity. The one Hitler came from, maybe our more liberal Western tradition, but all of it, nothing but subjective preference. It's me, the subject, deciding what moral code I want to adopt. Ask yourself this. What is the difference between a world where everyone creates their own moral standards and a world with no moral standards at all? Nothing, really. There is no difference. If everyone's deciding what's moral, you know, that's the same as no morality. What is needed is some kind of objective moral, not a subjective morality in here, but an objective morality out there that is true for all, binding on all. Yeah. Check out these students who have difficulties based on their no-God beginning point and find it difficult to be coherent about morals.
Well, first question that we have, do you think that there's like a universal moral law or not? What do you think about that?
No, I don't think there really is.
I wouldn't say necessarily a law, but I'm definitely a firm believer in like karma.
I think so. I think as humans just living, I think we have an obligation to just be kind to everyone.
In my elementary school, there was a treat others the way that you would be treated. Mm. I feel like that's probably like the most important one.
That's a good question. I think that most human beings, at least in today's world, have the same moral law. I just think some people decide to break that law and just kind of ignore it.
I mean, I have my own moral standards, like be kind, but everyone upholds their own things, so I guess that really depends on person to person.
Do you think if somebody who was a practicing Nazi or a practicing slave owner came up to you and they were like, what I believe is right, do you think you could definitively tell them that they are wrong, or do you think you'd have that perspective of, you know, it's just their perspective?
Yeah, no, that's a good question as well.
It's definitely like wrong. I don't think that should be really a thing. I feel like everybody really should be equal.
I feel like I've definitely been like thought about this before, and I'm a big advocate for just people believing in what they think. But I think there's a line that has to be drawn somewhere.
Those are pretty outdated things among society, and it's all looked down upon.
And you know, I think everyone should kind of have the ability to believe what they want to believe and voice what they want to voice. Granted, I think there's a very large gray area between what's right and what's wrong. And again, I feel like that comes back from my perspective.
I would more than likely try my best to educate them in some sense and give them facts and reasons behind my stance. I think one of the beautiful things is that we're all allowed to think whatever we want, even if it is wrong sometimes.
And also, it also comes back to, you know, society and kind of the environment they're in. You know, if you go back to the, you know, 1800s and ask about slavery, I'm sure it's a very moral thing to do because it's very normal.
I'd smack them silly. I'm Jewish. I'd smack them.
How do you think you could have the ground to say that they were wrong?
I mean, personally, people that are so strongly driven in those kind of beliefs normally don't have much background to base it off of, and I feel like wouldn't listen to me either, so I would probably just ignore it and let them be haters.
So do you think that your viewpoint is one that just you should subscribe to, or do you think that all people should subscribe to what you think?
I think everyone has the right to their own opinion. I think my viewpoint is a more common viewpoint on that matter, but again, people are allowed to think what they think.
So I think people should believe on some things I say, but like I don't, it's like other people should have other opinions. Like, I'm not going to judge anybody for what they say. It's like their opinion, so.
I think everybody's entitled to their own beliefs. Like for me personally, I'm not a religious person. And that's, I think, where a lot of my karma comes from, is that for me, karma kind of takes that place of religion and gives me something firm to believe in.
So I think kind of the idea of breaking the moral law is really like opinionated and based on the perspective that you're looking at it from, I think.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. So if the reference point in your thinking is self, again, there's no way to move from my opinion to what's actually binding. Maybe the world's that way. Maybe we just have to accept that. Huh? If we do, anything goes. And I mean anything. Yes, the Holocaust. That's where we wind up. And so, what's the point here? The point is, I am Yahweh. There's your beginning point. It's not you or not the beginning point. I am the beginning point. The one that created you, created the universe. I am the beginning point. And, you know, if we reject that, then we're really putting ourselves in that place. I become God. I become the arbiter of morality. And so we have 7 billion gods running around. It ain't going to be pretty. Moral norms, moral standards begin with a person. They're personal. They don't come out of a no-God materialistic universe. There's no place for morality anywhere in that. When we get to personal beings on a high level, we are on a high level. You know that. You can sense the presence of your own soul, your own consciousness. Yeah, I've got a body. It's pretty much like other animals, more or less. But there's also me in here. I'm in here. I know that. And I'm not like the others. I'm not like the other creatures. I'm on some way higher level. And that's why I am capable of moral wrongdoing or doing good. But this dog over here, this cat over here, is not. They might bite another dog, kill it. There's just being dogs. And so there's a huge division point. What in the Genesis is called God creating, let us create humans in our own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And so because we're on this higher level of the image of God, and because we have a relationship with God, moral thinking becomes comprehensible and it becomes objective. And that's why moral norms begin with a person. His name is Yahweh. That's right. Well, he says, I'm the God who rescued you out of the land of Egypt, out of the place of your slavery. What's this doing here? This is basically saying the context for moral knowledge is a loving, rescuing relationship. God is a rescuer. We get ourselves in trouble. We're all in trouble. We're all headed for the judgment of God. We're headed for major trouble. And God's like, I want to rescue you out of that. He's gone to terrific lengths to rescue us, sending his son to die. And so, yeah, morals cannot be an impersonal matter. Morals is something that exists between personal beings on a high order. Look at Deuteronomy 10. 13, you must keep the Lord's commandments and his statutes, which I'm instructing you today, for your own good. God's not trying to restrict us. He's not trying to hold us back from cool things. What he's doing is he's saying, take it easy on yourself. Don't destroy yourself. And when we think we can violate God's moral standard, what we end up doing is breaking ourselves and shredding our own soul. And that's what God's trying to save us from. First John 4:16, John says, we have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. Right, so there's a huge question here. Does God exist? Yes, that's a big one. And is he loving? If we don't think God is a loving being, we're not going to take anything from him. We're not going to be wanting to follow him. But if it turns out that he is a loving being, now we're on new ground, the ground where we can start to learn how to live a life of right instead of wrong. Verse 3, you must not have any other God before me. Now, what do we have here? Egotism? Neediness? No, not at all. Why should we have no other gods? In the first place, there are no other gods. No such thing as another god. In Isaiah 45, God says, I am Yahweh, and there is no other. Besides me, there is no god. So with these other gods that we come up with in, let's say, polytheism or whatever, where do they come from? We made them up. We created them. Man-made God. So now humans, instead of being created by God, here we're creating God. And yeah, there is no such God there. We made that up. And God says that I cannot accept. Fascinating to study ancient religion and see that with all these different legal codes and moral codes that we have from different cultures, none of them forbid worshiping other gods. This is the only one. Monotheism. I wonder how they came up with that. Pretty sharp. Maybe they didn't come up with it. Maybe God was talking to them through Moses. Verse 4, you must not make for yourself an idol or any kind of an image or anything in the heavens or on earth or in the sea. Yeah, why do religious people always have these objects that they, you know, kissing it and rubbing it and get energy, and then you can put it on the mantle. They're bringing God down to a tangible realm. The transcendent God has been reduced to something I carved with my pocket knife. And so it's offensive to God. He doesn't want you cannot carve a statue of God that represents him. He's too lofty for that. He's too transcendent for that. And this desire to have tangible, you know, pictures, objects of worship and so forth is really preferring, it's humans preferring an impersonal approach to God, where God has become a thing that I can come and look at and burn a candle to or whatever. And that's not what he is. We've missed the point at that junction. Verse 5, you must not bow down to them, you must not worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God who will not tolerate your affection for other gods. Yeah, I think we've got a problem right here. I am a jealous God. Old Testament Bible scholar Dunham says that the word jealousy comes from a Hebrew word that means to be red in the face. In the Old Testament, it does not connect with the human emotion we associate with envy, pettiness, and suspicion. It's, again, another King James tradition to say, for God to say, I'm a jealous God. The word is not translated that way elsewhere. It should be translated passionate. That God is passionate. Not is he needy, is he worried that he's going to miss out on something? No, he's worried about us and what it's going to do to us to worship other gods. That's going to take us straight away from the truth. It's going to be a spiraling down into an echo chamber where I'm creating what I want to hear, not really following God at all. And you'll end up alienated from God that way. So Martin Luther wrote, whatever your heart clings to and relies on, that is, properly speaking, your God. Well, we don't get into the carving stones that much anymore. Some of us have talismans or magic charms, whatever. More likely, as modern Westerners, we're interested in security and setting up a life of security and surrounding ourselves with layers of security. Getting a position, a high position that is admirable, getting power, feeling like, you know, I say jump and they ask how high. And some people love the feeling of power, social prestige, public admiration. Some people, it's love of country. For them, that's literally the mainspring of their life, is patriotism. Could be love of family. We're like, wait a minute, what's wrong with loving your family? Nothing. A lot of these don't have anything wrong with them until you take them out of their intended role and turn them into the center, the hub in your wheel that your wheel spins around, the place that should be have Yahweh there, should have God there. Now it's become an idol. That's taking you away from God. It could be your career. Not uncommon for any of these to replace God as our first commitment, says Trueblood. Elton Trueblood wrote a nice piece on this section of Exodus. He says, this commandment is really warning us against taking God lightly. That's probably true. Copan says, the divine passion should be seen as God's willing the best for his creatures. We have the ultimate right there before us. It's paid for. It's being offered to us. Instead, we're insisting on groveling around in the mud and eating mud. And God is upset by that. It's very upsetting to him. He loves these people. Why are they doing that? And he goes on, he says, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Okay, so I think what's being described here is really cause and effect, not inherited guilt. It's what we could call passive judgment, where God is like, I'm taking hands off, I'm not going to prevent that from happening. I could, but I'm not going to. And so we will find that when we oppose the will of God and decide to take a different course, damage is the result. And in family systems, you know, some of you maybe had an alcoholic father, let's say. That's not God's pattern. That's not God's will. And so he comes home and beats his wife and children. He's, you know, all kinds of problems. And those kids, you know, they didn't do anything wrong. And yet, they will often struggle with alcoholism themselves. And with the violence that comes with it. Why is it that 90% of all child abusers were abused themselves? Cause and effect. It's not a fate. We can avoid this. We can break the chain of inheritance. Yes, we can. By turning to the grace of God and getting under him to walk with him. We know that inherited guilt is false because Ezekiel says the son will not bear the punishment for the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself. So, and this is God speaking in this passage. So God is against the idea of you getting the blame for something someone else did. However, consequences that are just naturally follow. You know, you stand, you speed in your car at 100 miles an hour and you get in a crash, that's cause and effect. And no, he doesn't prevent that from happening to the whole world or even to his own believers. But, he says, I do lavish unfailing love for 1,000 generations on those who love me and keep my instructions. 1,000 compared to 3 or 4 generations. This is he's stressing, I'm way more into blessing people, giving them good lives than I am into punishing people. I hate that. A number of passages where God says, I hate the fact that I have to punish, but that's his moral character as a just God, as we studied earlier. Yeah. Well, verse 7, you must not misuse the name of the Lord your God. The Lord will not let you go unpunished if you misuse his name. So misusing the name of God, a lot of people interpret this to mean cursing or swearing. And in fundamental churches, they're just, you know, really very, it's one of the worst things you can do is swear or curse. What do you think of Deuteronomy 6:13? You must fear the Lord your God and serve him. When you swear an oath, you must use only his name. Yeah, actually swearing is prescribed, provided it's done properly, and that you're not swearing falsely. That is probably what he's talking about. The word here for misuse usually means falsely. And in the King James, it's called using the Lord's name in vain, which I think is a little weak. Falsely, yeah. Possibly false oaths that you're taking, misusing his name that way. If you swear an oath, I swear by the Lord God, and you know perfectly well it's untrue. That's that's bold. That's just like giving him the finger at that point. Or magic is another possibility. The ancient people believed once you knew somebody's name, they would have a public name. But then they had a private name that was a real name, and they didn't give that out because people would try to use it. They thought they could use it to cast spells. And there may be, that may be in view here as well. Finally, remember to observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. You have 6 days each week for your ordinary work, but the seventh day isn't a Sabbath day of rest. It's dedicated to the Lord your God. On that day, no one in your household may do any work. This includes you, your sons, your daughters, your male and female servants, your livestock, and any foreigners that's living with you. Everybody gets a day of rest. We already went over this last week. For in 6 days, the Lord made the heavens, the earth, and the sea, and everything in them. But on the seventh day, he rested. That is why the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and set it aside as holy. In the Old Testament covenants, we're going to be studying more about covenants, agreements, contracts. This is the Moses covenant, the Mosaic covenant. And this Sabbath day is a mark of the Mosaic covenant. Each covenant has a mark. The one with Noah was the rainbow. The one with Abraham was circumcision. This one is Sabbath day. And yeah, so we already discussed it. I won't belabor you with it again. All right, so far, here we are halfway through. The first half of the 10 sayings has to do with our relationship with God. The second half has to do with our relationship with each other. And so we'll cover that part next week. It turns out that love is really at the bottom of both of these. We've seen that good and evil are real. Whether people believe it or whether they don't, maybe Hitler was cynical and just felt like he could do whatever he wanted. It didn't matter whether it was right or wrong. That doesn't really change anything, whatever he thought. This person thought, that person thought, the majority of people thought. It's not up to a vote. Morality is objective. It's out there. It's fixed. It's fixed on the character of the Creator God. His character is what defines good and evil. They're not socially constructed. I'm not saying societies don't construct moral norms and standards. They do. But when they're constructing these on their own, so yeah, again, we can look at Hitler's Germany. They basically had a high level of agreement on anti-Semitism. That was a tradition that went back hundreds of years in Germany. So here is a culture that has socially constructed a moral norm, kill the Jew. And yet, well, it was wrong. It was absolutely wrong. That's not the standard. The socially constructed moral is not the standard. The standard is the absolute objective standard of the Creator God. That's who we answer to. Good and evil are objective, yes. They're also hierarchical, meaning they're not all the same. Some things are more important than others. So we'll see, as we get into case law, we'll see that in some cases you follow one moral standard instead of the other one because it's a moral dilemma, and this one's more important than that. That's a nuance that some people haven't fiddled with much. Good and evil exist because we're created by an infinite personal God, and it begins with our relationship with him. If you don't have a relationship with God, then there's probably you're not going to follow his pattern for right and wrong, right? So that's a big question, whether God is there and whether I have a relationship with him. I wonder if you have that. Or is it something really vague? Maybe you're not really sure whether you have a relationship with him or not. How do you get a relationship with God? You ask for it. It's not hard. You tell God, I don't understand everything about this, but I do want to have a relationship with you. And I recognize that I need you in my life, and you invite him in. Receiving Christ is what that's called. You could do that right here tonight. You don't have to make a big deal of it. You just, if you feel moved in your heart to reach out to God, you just reach out to him in your mind and just say, I want you in my life. And I submit myself to your leadership. Yeah. Nice. As far as the other question, how do we know God even exists? Okay. Stop by the coffee bar. You can have a short book that explains how we know that. See whether you think it's persuasive or not. Free of charge. Free book. Yes, God, if we lived in a world without you, anything would go. And we would just be lost when it came to moral understanding. We thank you that you are the true basis for a moral goodness in the universe. We thank you that you are a God of love. Goodness and love are linked together very closely. And we thank you that we can know you in a personal way and have a relationship with you. And I pray for anyone that's thinking about that right now, would just not even hesitate, but just go ahead and ask you to start that relationship tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.